Welcome to another edition of the Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin. I'm your host, RJ McGill.
In the talking picture, Mutiny on the Bounty from 1935, there's a scene in which Clark Gable lays on the beach of his tropical island. A wonderful sweet melody drifts through the palm trees. Clark Gable knows immediately this is a composition by Walter Jurmann. He heard the song in the earlier part of the film, Love Song of Tahiti.
Almost every Berliner knows that voice, that accent, and that distinctive cadence. It belongs to Max Rabe, the incredibly accomplished musician and band leader of the Palast Orchestra, who has brought back to today's audiences the popular music of Berlin of the 1920s and 30s. Most of the composers and performers of this music were forced to flee Nazi Germany. Many found work in the U.S., especially Hollywood, like Walter Jurmann, the composer of Love Song of Tahiti. On this particular evening, Max Rabe was delighting an invited audience of distinguished Germans and Americans gathered at the Hans Arnold Center in Wannsee for a very special celebration, the 20th anniversary of the American Academy in Berlin. In the 1920s and 30s, music like this was often heard in the villa that was then the home of the family of banker Hans Arnold. This villa has been the home of the American Academy in Berlin since its creation, and serves as the symbol of a lasting bond between Germany and the United States since 1994.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that if I were prone to nightmares, it would be having to follow Max Rabe. So I can't imagine a worse circumstance to give any kind of talk at any length. And if you ever wanted a witness to the transatlantic partnership between Germany and the United States, it is the music of the 20s and the early 30s, which is unthinkable without the American influence. And this is a transatlantic symbiosis, and it was worth the entire trip to Berlin.
The more serious comments at the anniversary celebration fell to Leon Botstein, president of Bard College, director of the American Symphony Orchestra and a noted musicologist and author. In his comments, the creation of the American Academy was placed in the context of a post-Cold War world and in the wake of the catastrophic Nazi era's devastation of the arts and culture in Germany. Here's an excerpt from his remarks.
What's very interesting as I stand here in the garden of this house is that the American Academy is the creature of a very unusual nostalgia. And that nostalgia, we heard a wonderful evocation by Max Rabe. And that's the nostalgia of the German Jewish emigres. The Arnold family, the Kellen family, Richard Holbrooke himself, Henry Kissinger, all American emigres of German Jewish origin, who, unlike the other European refugees, always held a tremendously deep affection for Germany. Despite everything, there is no such academy possible funded by descendants of Polish Jewry in Poland. Nothing is thinkable remotely like this in Russia among the Russian Jewish emigration. Ironically, with the unification, Germany has reemerged as actually hugely powerful economically, politically, and culturally. There is no doubt that this city is and will remain for decades to come the cultural capital of Europe. I actually think the American Academy is about the belief that through art, education, through research, through what we call the humanities, that somehow there is some connection between the flourishing of those activities and the way we conduct our political and personal lives. That there's a link between democracy and freedom and learning, a link between learning and art and the notion of freedom. Especially in the contemporary world in which, with modern technology, the public space has changed very dramatically. The expression of ideas by individuals in real time and real space is actually the last bastion of dissent. We talk a lot about freedom, but very few of us use it. We say we like dissent, but we really don't like to hear somebody say something we don't already believe. So the fact remains is that the American Academy is a kind of crucible meeting place where people can figure out not only how to resist what's happening through a form of inner emigration, both under Stalin and Hitler, the technique of inner emigration, using the imaginative capacities of poets, particularly musicians, to keep their freedom intact under the radar screen of censors and tyrants. That's not enough. The sense of dissent, dialogue, scholarship, finding that that which is held to be true may not be true, that that process is vital in a way that cannot be only interior to ourselves, but in the public discourse.
Leon Botstein, president of Bard College, author and musicologist, speaking at the 20th anniversary celebration for the American Academy in Berlin. The importance of the occasion was clearly recognized by the Germans who spoke that evening, including German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier.
Das war wichtig, weil es ist doch so, dass...
It must be said that some in Germany still hold and nurse their prejudice toward American culture for its supposedly shallow nature. The American Academy and its many fellows have always served as living proof that this is a false perception. It is exactly this open-minded approach, which stretches across the Atlantic, that the American Academy stands for. It breathes life into it on a daily basis. It spreads the charm and fruits of critical thinking. Jean Monnet, one of the fathers of European unity, gave us the wise words, "Nothing is possible without men, but nothing is lasting without institutions." The American Academy, whose 20th anniversary we are celebrating today, is a truly remarkable institution. Yet it would never have come into being without equally remarkable people, who, with their imagination, experience, passion, and vision, created and breathed life into this jewel of transatlantic encounters.
German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Among the many salutes and tributes, perhaps the most often noted individual present was the Academy's director for the past 17 years, Gary Smith, who ended his incredibly successful term at the organization's helm at the end of 2014. Author, reporter, columnist, and Academy trustee Roger Cohen offered his assessment, which all of us at the Academy share.
Gary has filled this place with his alchemy, something not quite tangible, but absolutely remarkable. Gary is a bridger of the unbridgeable. He brings together the diverse. He creates harmony where you would least expect it. And in so doing, he has created a place that is quite unique in the world.
Roger Cohen, one of the many tributes to Gary Smith at the 20th anniversary celebration for the American Academy in Berlin. In a moment, we'll hear from one of the fall semester's fellows at the Academy, a historian who enjoys poking around in history's dark corners. We'll be back after this short break. You're listening to the Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin.
Let's go.
Hi, this is Bob Boylan, host of NPR's All Songs Considered, here to remind you to view the entire archive of our Tiny Desk concerts at nprmusic.org.
All right, okay. All right, okay. All right, okay. All right, okay. Now,
return to the mat. What it is, what it does, what it is, what it isn't. Looking for a better way to get up out of bed instead of getting on the internet and checking a new hit.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal. I'm RJ McGill, and this is Monica Black.
For me, this is one of the most fascinating periods, I would say, in human history.
As an associate professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Monica Black teaches modern German history with an emphasis on the period during the World Wars and in the immediate post-World War II era, starting in 1945. During her time as a fellow this past semester at the American Academy, Monica Black focused in on what fascinates her most about Germany in the aftermath of the war, the often strange and puzzling moral and social phenomena that took hold of the German population, devastated by defeat and searching for meaning, and perhaps most of all, for healing. The center of her study is a man named Bruno Gröning, a self-styled faith healer who emerged from the ashes and rubble to captivate millions of Germans, all of whom were in desperate need of comfort in the wake of one war and in the shadow of the beginning of a new one, the Cold War. Monica Black sat down with the Berlin Journal in the Academy's library for a conversation with Dean of Fellows Wolf Schaefer, a friend and fellow historian.
You have a population of people in defeat, and you have this enormous looming conflict, which is coming soon after, which everyone can, you know, the anticipation of this looming conflict, which becomes the Cold War, is, it's not apparent to people, say, in 1945, but there are indications that there are going to be tensions.
And you think it was already in somewhat felt by the people, or is it that we see it from the back sight, our knowledge?
No, I think the average person was completely in the dark about a lot of these things, was completely in the dark about the possible tensions between the Western Allies and the Soviets. It's not so much that. I'm thinking more about this moment as a sort of historical period in which there were many forces at many different levels that are impinging
on the scene. We can see now that this was such a special moment.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the wake of a not only catastrophically lost war and failed war effort, the second in a few decades, this catastrophic loss. Yeah. And then the moral, massive, as you put it, moral collapse, moral catastrophe of the Holocaust, and all of that sort of looming in the background. And then what I'm always interested in as a historian is what ordinary people are doing in everyday life that is somehow contributing something to the picture that we can later see as having been, you know, an intrinsic part of the history of that moment, which wasn't necessarily perceived at the time as having been important to the making of that moment. What I'm really interested in the book that I'm working on now is the things that are unspoken, the things that are in between, the things that are sort of subterranean.
And that's where you also see your service, so to speak, as a historian. I mean, the things that are not spoken about to bring to life or to speak about.
I like historical topics that offer the possibility or hold out the possibility of finding out something about the psychology of a particular moment. Now, I mean, you know, what was called psychohistory at a particular moment in time in the 60s and 70s is something that's been rightfully discredited. I'm not talking about doing that kind of history. I'm not talking about that kind of history, you know, warmed over. But I am interested in what can be said about the psychology of a moment in time. Not, say, of a group of people in some sort of monolithic or uniform sense.
Yeah, I think I understand. You don't mean to apply the discipline of psychology now to history, but that there are feelings in the field of history, in the force field of history, that you want to tease out.
Exactly. That's right. So the way that I'm sort of doing this in the book is I'm looking at a variety of really, I think, very unexpected phenomena. They were very unexpected to me, and that's why I assume that they would be unexpected to other people. I'm looking at things like apparitions of the Virgin Mary, of which there were hundreds and hundreds, not just in Germany, throughout Europe. I'm looking at things like accusations of witchcraft, which is also something that's not necessarily unique by any means to Germany.
But surprising.
Surprising. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Particularly in the 20th century, we sort of think of those things as belonging to a different past.
Right.
And I'm looking at the rise of this faith healer who just lit Germany, West Germany, up in the years, just really right in the period right around the moment when the Parliament of Germany, the Bundestag, approved the Basic Law, and West Germany was created as an independent state.
I understand. I mean, I wanted to ask you about that. This faith healer is Bruno Gröning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never heard about him, I have to say, although I'm old enough to... I was around at the time, but I was a little boy.
Yeah.
So what is so interesting about this character?
Bruno Gröning is fascinating for a million reasons. He's fascinating because he seemed to come out of nowhere. He was himself a refugee from what was then called Danzig, which is now the city of Gdansk on the Baltic in Poland. He fought in the war. He was a POW, and he ends up in sort of the western part of what becomes West Germany after the war, and almost accidentally, it seems, he was involved in what to those people who were observing this at the time believed was the miraculous healing of a young boy of muscular dystrophy. This little boy had been in bed for days and days and days, unable to get up. And Bruno Gröning legendarily, right, said, go outside and play. And the boy got up and went outside and played. This is the story.
Mm-hmm.
And out of this story developed a media phenomenon of unbelievable proportions. I mean, I sort of think of Bruno Gröning as you know, West Germany's first rock star. This is before rock and roll.
Right, right.
But on the other hand, I think of him as, or I see him as, and I write about him as a portent. He's an omen. He's a sign. He's a thing that requires interpretation.
A sign for what?
That's right. A sign for what? So everybody wants to know, what is the meaning of this guy? Who is he? What does he want? Why is he doing this? What motivates him? And it becomes almost a cottage industry. People from every walk of life, from the person on the street or the person riding the streetcar to medical doctors and psychiatrists and government ministers, to discuss him and try to understand what is happening with him, what's happening with the people who are so drawn to him,
right,
and what are we going to do about all of this?
And the media you mentioned, that was radio and papers, or what was it?
It was print media and radio. He appeared on the radio, and he was written about it literally from the Boulevard Press, you know, from the sort of the tabloid press, what we would now think of as the tabloid press, to, you know, he was on the front cover of the Spiegel at a certain point.
And did he preach? Did he give, like, sermons or something like that?
I'd say that he gave talks where he would sort of greet a crowd of enthusiastic cure seekers.
Huh.
And the gatherings that he amassed, at a certain point, there were gatherings of as many as 15 to 18,000 people at a given time. And he would go out of this, there was a place, there's a city near Munich called Rosenheim. He was living there for a period of time. And people were coming out. Every day more people would come. A few people would leave and more people would come. And these crowds were building and building and building. And he would go out sometimes once a day, sometimes more often. And he would greet the crowds and he would talk to them about what it means to heal. And this is the interesting thing to me, is actually from a historical perspective, medicine isn't just a history of the way that doctors treat illness or the history of disease. It's also the history of how human beings relate to the sense in which they are healthy or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sickness as a social phenomenon is a constantly evolving thing, right? So that's part of what's happening here, is
right.
I'm trying to sort of look at, it's not so much that Gröning is sort of going out and preaching to people, but he is telling them what's needed to be healthy and what he says is needed to be healthy.
It's such a particular moment. I mean, here's Germany defeated.
Yes.
And the population had heard for 12 years all these speeches by Nazi speakers, right? Hitler.
Goebbels.
And Goebbels and all those. And had these huge rallies.
Yes.
And had Leni Riefenstahl illuminating the rallies and things like that.
Right.
So would you say that the German population was prepared by the modus operandi of Nazism for this kind of delivery?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. Although that cuts in various ways, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, almost immediately people say, this is making me extremely uncomfortable. What's going on with this guy? And Gröning himself had been a member of the Nazi Party, a regular rank and file member. But there were people around him people who worked in his sort of team, who one of whom was had been a member of the SS, and one of whom had worked in Goebbels, or was some kind of liaison, I haven't quite figured this out yet, was some kind of a liaison between...
In the propaganda ministry.
Yes, mm-hmm. In the propaganda ministry. People pointed that out immediately. But I think what's also happening is that people are concerned about whether or not the population was primed for that kind of a delivery. People are very concerned that he represents a sort of continuation of Nazism. He represents a sort of a longing for miracles. It actually disturbs people, this mm-hmm. longing for miracles. And we can think about things like...
But when you say disturbs people, is this people who are critical? Let's say the journalists that write about it or so. Yes.
Although not all journalists by any means are critical.
Uh-huh.
Many, the Spiegel is critical. And you know, the people who write about it in the Spiegel are relentlessly sort of ironic about the whole thing, which is very, it's very funny to read their pieces. But there are other journalists, many other journalists who write about what's happening. And actually, I would say, give energy to the sense that the whole thing is somehow supernatural, what's happening is supernatural, and that Gröning is some kind of Gottgesandter, that he's come from God, that he's on a divine mission. You know, that Hitler was a kind of Messiah, and that this guy is a kind of Messiah.
In a way, it points backwards. In a way, it changes the discourse because it's not political or the German race or something, but it's now healing. So, yes. I mean, it fits into the moment, it seems, that this is a, I don't want to say sick country, but it's not a sick moment or whatever, but it's a moment of deep hurt in a way. And so maybe he speaks to a longing for healing that we can see in that context as real, but it seems to be also shot through with actual miracles or believed things that are miracles in healing. Is that true?
Yes. No, that's exactly right. So there's both. I mean, on the one hand, and a lot of people say this at the time, they say, Gröning is not the problem, he's a symptom. He's a symptom of a much bigger problem, which I would sort of categorize as war wounds, sort of in quotation marks. On the one hand, it's very interesting about this moment that in Germany at this time, there's not really the discourse of trauma doesn't really exist in Germany. There's another discourse, which is a discourse about psychosomatic illness and about hysteria, which is not the same thing by any means as a neurosis created by trauma, something like that, right? But there is a very strong tendency of a lot of people who are commenting on what's happening to talk about the people who are coming in these huge groups and who are sitting, you know, forlorn and without a friend in the world on these sort of these open fields night after night in the rain, in the dark, in the cold, waiting for the chance to see him. One of the most interesting pieces of journalism that came out of the moment was a story written by a couple of journalists who had interviewed and worked with Gröning extensively. And they went through some tens of thousands of letters that people had sent to Gröning. And they sort of gave a synopsis of these letters. And what they said again and again was that so many of the people had no one to talk to about how they felt about things. They had no one to whom they could express their despair. And the currency of the notion of psychotherapy was zero. Mm-hmm. So there was no sense of, you know, that there was someone else or that they could go to their doctor and talk about that because they couldn't. So it's all of those things. And that's why I think it makes for such an interesting moment because it is both, as you put it so well, we can see the past flowing into the present or there's a mm-hmm. continuous stream from the past into the present. And then sort of new things are emerging, new ways of talking about health, new ways of talking about medicine. A lot of doctors are concerned, for example, that, you know, why can't we help these people? Right. What does it mean that we can't help
right,
them?
Right, and why are they flocking to him? Yeah.
Yes.
I can understand that in that moment, such a person may emerge and have this enormous attraction. But still, I mean, the faith healing, the miracles and all that, and people sitting on fields, it sounds really very distant to me. So again, I would say it's something that in this particular moment, 45 to 49 or something like that, happens. But now the historian, you, who uncovers this story, Do we have to say this was an event that will probably never occur again? Or do you see in this something that is not dated completely, but is something that we have to expect or might expect or so?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And I think about, sometimes I think about the way that I think about this project as an American as opposed to a German. You know, I'm not German. Mm-hmm. In the United States, I would have to say that these kinds of phenomena, maybe not on the scale of a Gröning. I mean, in the 19th century, we could probably certainly talk about, in the early 20th century, yes. also talk about right. Phenomena of this kind. But I feel like these phenomena are almost more expected in a certain way.
That's very interesting. So what you are saying actually is it may not happen in present-day Germany, but you would not rule it out that there is a ground or a cultural environment in the United States.
Yes. I think actually Germany is probably uniquely, in some ways, unreceptive at this point in its history.
Yeah, I think I have the same impression. But that's very important because...
It is.
And it leads me to maybe another question I would like to ask. Somewhere I read that you are interested in the dark corners of history. And, and so I'm wondering, I mean, one could say as a kind of, let's say, a realist, political realist, so don't get interested in the dark corners. These are just the exceptions or so, right? Mm-hmm. Concentrate on what's really in the center and important and so on and so forth. I'm wondering about the relevance of the dark corners mm-hmm. that you have stressed somewhere, that this is something that interests you and draws you in. And I think I can understand it, but let me say, maybe the dark corners are dark corners for a reason.
Right, right.
And we should not spend so much attention writing a whole book. I mean, that's not right. done in a day. On the dark corners, when other things are in the center and more important or so, mm-hmm. why is the dark corner telling you so much?
Yeah. No, it's a very fair question. I would say this. I would say that there's not a single aspect of post-war history that this story doesn't touch on. So it touches on politics. It touches on the law. It touches on the recreation of medical practice in Germany after the war. It touches on nascent tendencies in German psychology after the war. And when I say that, I mean sort of the practice of psychology. It touches on religion and religious belief and religious practice. It touches on gender relationships. There's not anything, I think, I don't want to exaggerate too much, but there are very few topics that this one does not intersect with in an interesting way. My argument for looking at the corners rather than the middle is that when you look at the corner, there are a lot of questions going on in the center that can be addressed by looking at more conventional topics. But when you go to the corner, the perspective that you can gain on those questions of the center changes. There's a uh-huh. perspectival okay. shift. And I also think, you know, for me, a lot of history treats human beings as though we're pretty, in some ways, we're pretty tidy beings. Like we're, you know, we have certain kinds of needs that have to be met. We work, we create economies, we create laws and we have politics. Well, those things are all real and important. And yet, human beings are fundamentally more complicated and much more weird than many of our historical narratives, I think, would seem to suggest.
I think German history has told us that, no?
I think that's true.
Monica Black, an associate professor of German history at the University of Tennessee, and a fellow at the Academy this fall, in conversation with the Academy's Dean of Fellows, Wolf Schaefer. After a short break, I'll be back with another fall semester fellow, writer Adam Ross, to talk about some scary moments in real life and in fiction. You're listening to the Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin. I'm RJ McGill.
I'm Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. NPR is good stories, well told. From around the world, Libya to Louisiana, from refugee camps to palaces, NPR tells the stories of soldiers, stockbrokers, teachers, barbers, bagel bakers, filmmakers, scientists, and high school basketball stars. It's fair and it's fun. No talking heads, real people. This is NPR.
I had just come off a period of deep obsession with the work of Alfred Hitchcock, who, of course, you can pick up anywhere in his canon. And there's no plot he loves more, except for maybe a wrong man accused of a crime of uxoricide, of wife murder, spouse murder.
When David Pepin first dreamed of killing his wife, he didn't kill her himself. He dreamed convenient acts of God. So begins Mr. Peanut, the daring, arresting first novel by Adam Ross, an author of prodigious talent, which takes as its theme the dual nature of marriage, the proximity of violence, and love. A quote from Scott Turow's 2010 New York Times review of Adam Ross's debut novel, Mr. Peanut. Mr. Peanut, of course, was an immediate success, and it went on to be published in 16 countries. Now, following publication of a book of short stories, Ladies and Gentlemen, Adam Ross is at work on his next novel, Play World, based on the time during his New York City childhood where he worked as a child actor. As you might expect, it's a whole lot more than that, and we'll hear Adam read from his work in progress in just a few moments. One of the perks of this job is that I get to sit down and chat with some of the fellows who live and work at the Academy each semester, and for today's Berlin Journal, I was delighted to have the opportunity to talk with author Adam Ross.
Your first novel, Mr. Peanut, hilarious, scary. Stephen King said it even scared him. It's centered around a man named David Pepin, who may or may not have killed his wife, and her death is being investigated by two detectives, both of whose marriages we come to see intimately through the novel. Was there a particular event or idea that gave rise to this sprawling investigative novel?
Yes, absolutely. My father, one summer day in 1995, told me about the very suspicious suicide of my cousin, a woman who suffered from a trifecta of illnesses. She had dealt with terrible depression throughout her life. She was morbidly obese due to a thyroid condition and also allergic to nuts. And according to her husband, who was the only witness to her alleged suicide, he claimed that he came home one afternoon. She was sitting in the kitchen in front of a plate full of peanuts. They got into an argument, and at the height of the argument, she grabbed the handful of peanuts and ate them. She had also conveniently hidden her EpiPens from him, and so she died of anaphylactic shock right in front of him. Now, at that time, I had just come off a period of deep obsession with the work of Alfred Hitchcock, and who, of course, you can pick up anywhere in his canon, and there's no plot he loves more, except for maybe a wrong man accused of a crime of uxoricide, of wife murder, spouse murder. Immediately, I was thunderstruck. And so I sat down upon hearing this story and wrote the first three chapters of Mr. Peanut in a single sitting. It remains one of the biggest bursts of writing I've ever done in a straight shot, but I thought I was writing a short story at the time. It just grew and grew and took on other characters and took on a much more complex narrative structure than I'd originally anticipated. And so, you know, I was off to essentially a decade-long race, process, nightmare, whatever you want to call it, the composition of such a thing, during which time I also wrote a book of short stories as I was taking breaks from
it. I wanted to ask if you were, you know, you're also a journalist, and you're working for the Nashville Scene for five, six years as a journalist.
Right.
And I don't mean this superficially, but did some of the skills that you had to hone as a reporter matter in constructing the details of a narrative that were about a murder in any way? I mean, maybe the answer is yes, but maybe you can tell me in which ways those two things overlapped.
You know, there's so many ways still that working in journalism, in spite of the ways in which that profession has changed, are so integral and so important for any narrative artist. Most importantly, just journalism's absolute insistence on ironclad structure, stories with a beginning, middle, and end, stories that announce right from the get-go in the way, in the simple ways that all great narrative announces what its subject is.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can measure any great work by its ability, and any great work of prose fiction, and the way in which it you just immediately recognize the plight of the main characters. So there's real training in journalism in terms of framing a story. And then even more importantly for me, on the back end of the process of working on such like a complex novel like Mr. Peanut, there was the subsequent editing process. And I don't just mean working with a great editor, but also taking a really hard look at your own work and asking yourself, what speaks to the main idea? And being very willing, if not enthusiastic about, or very enthusiastic about killing anything that isn't apropos, that isn't of the subject. So, because when you're working in journalism, you're working under deadline, you're working with space limitations. Invariably, when you're working in journalism, you discover that in fact, you could have said it with even fewer words.
Do you feel like that's almost a secret weapon or a sort of, I don't know, a second brain that you're able to bring to fiction that's to your advantage at all times? Or are there times where you wish the sort of monitoring of economy is cumbersome?
I'm pretty sure I understand what you're asking. And for me, I certainly give precedence to momentum in storytelling. I am a big believer in that great quote, you know, here's my advice to all amateurs giving a performance. Speak up and keep the act moving. I think that there's a lot of prose out there that maybe gets a little too bogged down in the sentence as opposed to the story. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big believer in the wonders and the energy of the sentence. But the side of me that, again, wants to really always hew to the subject, wants to show you the characters' faces, mm-hmm. tell you what they said.
Because there seems, and I ask, because there seems to be in reading your short stories, and more so in the presentation that you gave here, and the reading that you gave here in early September, there's a real feeling of control, and in a good way. There's a certain, I mean, mastery is, you know, too old fashioned a word, but there's really a sense that this story is going where you want it to go.
You know, I mean, thank you. That to me is, that's what you aspire to. I'm always stunned when I look at the work of, you know, those writers who are to me the greatest prose fiction writers. They seem to be able, with the fewest number of moves, to get right to the heart of the matter.
Mm.
And so for me, there's so much time is spent getting stuff down on paper and then sloughing it off. In fact, when I think about my own artistic process for me is more akin to sculpture. I feel like the story is somewhere in the rock, and I'm knocking out pieces of the rock to get down to the thing itself. I love, for instance, you know, I love Brancusi. And to me, Brancusi is this writer, is this sculptor of these incredibly elemental, simple forms, and yet think of all the rock he's got to go through. So,
ladies and gentlemen, the Book of Short Stories, there are a lot of characters that are one-on-one relationships that are not necessarily, they're not romantic relationships, but there's a professor and a maintenance man, there's two brothers, there are the strangers who meet on the plane. It seems like that, the theme of a relationship between two people runs through each of the stories almost. And secondly, were there any of these characters that you were particularly fond of or had an especially good time or difficult time dealing with or creating?
Even in the two stories you mentioned, you have a recurring motif where, you know, one character invites another character to tell him or her his story. And I'm really interested in the moral contract that's actually entered into between storyteller and listener, because there's a great deal of trust, hopefully, on both sides when you invite somebody to do that. And you're inviting somebody to share their own innermost lives, and you're also opening yourself up to certain kinds of change and self-reflection. So for instance, in the case of the first story, the rest of it, where this lonely professor invites this maintenance man to come in and, you know, it just starts with them just sort of chewing the fat, and the maintenance man has these incredible stories of Caribbean blood and death on the high seas. But then the professor in sort of a fit of enthusiasm says, well, let's make this into a book. You know, you can really tell me your stories. We can make it into a book. And the first story that the maintenance man tells him is one that immediately implicates the professor in what may be an absolutely horrific crime. So, you know, in that case, you get more than you bargain for. And then subsequently, what do you do? You know, I'm really interested in those moments. I'm really interested in those situations where just hearing a thing engenders the necessity for some form of action, mm-hmm. and what that means. We think about it. This happens all the time. In the internet age, in the age of mass communication, we constantly hear stuff that invites us, stories that invite us to either sit back, relax, and ignore the world's entropy, or do something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the most fundamental contracts with the world we have.
We're listening to a conversation with writer Adam Ross, a fellow this past semester here at the American Academy in Berlin. In late September, Adam Ross read from his work in progress, a novel titled Play World, for an invited audience at the American Academy. Here's a brief excerpt of that reading. The narrator has caused a major fire in his family's apartment in New York City, and his father has just come back to his family from a violent encounter with a crooked insurance agent who has cheated him out of thousands of dollars.
The fire was no tragedy, as I had said, though because of it, I suffered a trauma. It occurred the following Sunday. By then, my mother had found us a place uptown on 88th and West End Avenue, this new apartment so much larger than its predecessor that Orrin and I no longer needed to share a room. We were meagerly packed and ready to move from Alan Neal's the next day, but when my father appeared at the door, I somehow knew he'd come for me alone. I ran, hiding beneath the bed, but my father dragged me by my wrist from its safety. I vividly remember backpedaling with all the strength I had, grabbing a doorknob in passing, a chair, a table's leg. I was as willing to pull my arm from its socket as a lizard to jettison its tail. But it was no use. Exhausted, gone limp, my father gathered me into his arms and carried me down the hallway to our decimated apartment. The keyhole had been knocked out by the fireman, and from its circle sprung pink insulation flecked with soot. He touched the door, and it swung inward easily to reveal the floor was still covered with water. This standing lake, ash, and debris flecked, its surreal incongruousness straight out of a nightmare. I was afraid that its black surface hid fall-offs, sharp objects, that he might deposit me in it and leave me there. My father walked me through every room. He pointed out the black streaks climbing to sharp points where flames had licked them, the melted fixtures, our blackened clothes. Though most terrifying by far was the stench, this cold must, like the carcass of a drowned dragon. Having come full circle, having finally returned to the front door, my father stopped so that I might take a final look. When he was satisfied the image was indelible, he broke his silence. "Never again," he said to me. Within a year, I made my first television appearance. Thank you.
Writer Adam Ross, reading from his unfinished novel Play World on September 25th at the American Academy in Berlin. During his semester as a fellow at the Academy, Ross worked on the novel and a screenplay adaptation of his earlier novel, Mr. Peanut. Back now to our conversation with Adam Ross.
And so the natural question is, how much of that happened? And how much of this deal with the insurance man actually went down?
The way to translate the question is, you know, what's the relationship between autobiography and fiction, or you know, where does that book fall on the continuum of autobiography and fiction?
Yes.
Play World, from the outside looking in, it's superficially a very autobiographical book because I was a child actor, and because it takes place in Manhattan, this where I grew up. So, as a child actor, I started acting professionally when I was 11, and quit when I was 16. And the reason I quit at 16 was because I was a high school wrestler and wanted to focus on wrestling. What I've transformed the story into is a story of identity about, you know, a kid who's struggling with figuring out what role to play in the age of our actor president. I have used certain details from my life. When I was 4 years old, I did accidentally burn down my parents' apartment. However, the main thrust of that narrative is a story about my parents dealing with this rogue, crooked insurance agent, which required an enormous amount of narrative and invention, right? Of just making stuff up. The point is, and this is something that I think is always misunderstood about fiction writing and stuff that seems autobiographical, rarely is one's own story that interesting. One's own story has to be interesting on the page, and it's the job of the fiction writer, using his or her imagination, to change things however necessary to make it something worth reading. And so in the case of Play World, so much was invented. Number one being, I certainly wasn't there dealing with this crooked insurance agent in a car, giving him kickbacks and thinking about my honeymoon with my mother, which would definitely get me on a psychiatrist's couch, right? You have to invent things, you have to change, but also the truism is true. You write what you know, and I'm writing about an environment and a time, not only that I know, but you know what, that is gone. The New York actor that I was, that especially my father was, is a species that is extinct in Manhattan, and so I'm just trying to render that species as realistically as possible.
And this is now, you have the opportunity now, I know while you're here at the Academy, you're hoping to, or you're working on turning Mr. Peanut into a screenplay. This is maybe a similar transaction, in that when something goes to the screen, you're enlivening it once again on the page for a different kind of audience and for a different kind of animation. What's that been like?
It's been a study, first of all, in, this sounds negative, but it's really not meant to be. It's a recognition of the form's limits. But the screenplay itself is really a very flimsy form, meaning, you know, in 120 to 140 pages, you can only hang so much flesh. You can only hang so much on that scaffolding, right? You can only include so much information. So there's an enormous amount, again, of sacrifice, of letting certain things go. I'm writing about the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case, which was a very famous murder that took place in 1954. Dr. Sam Shepard was accused of brutally murdering his pregnant wife, Marilyn. And at the time, it was considered the trial of the century, not only because at the heart of it was this brutal murder full of adultery, sex, and bloody death, but also it was the dawn of the nexus of radio and television, of new forms of media coming along, very much like the OJ trial, where, you know, the internet was just really exploding. So it's asking yourself, what is most necessary, most essential to telling this story in the best way possible in a short amount of time?
Mm-hmm. So Play World is obviously largely, or at least in part, is going to be autobiographical because it concerns a child actor. And you and I had spoken before about the restraint that's required sometimes to not put yourself as the subject in the front of the story. And I wanted to take a step out from just your specific books. I want to talk about a figure like Lena Dunham, where the author steps to the fore in such a way that every last little detail is revealed. And I wanted to ask you, as a crafter of story, but also as a reporter, your opinion about that trend, which is definitely part of a larger movement in American history of recent American history of self-revelation in front of millions. I would like to hear your thoughts.
Well, full disclosure, I don't know Lena Dunham's work. However, certain writers, certain entertainers, certain writer-entertainers are better than others at talking about themselves. Or I'll even say, certain writers are better at seeming to talk about themselves. Saul Bellow is one. You know, you could argue that The Adventures of Augie March, Saul Bellow's third book, was the book where he opened the floodgates and talked about himself more autobiographically and powerfully and volcanically than any of his works before, and oscillated between that kind of narrative, you know, from the control of Seize the Day to then another, you know, volcanic book like Herzog. Philip Roth is another Jewish American modernist who always seems, using the avatar of Zuckerman, to be talking about himself, but plays with that. So to me, the answer to the question, what do I think of it? You know, it depends how much art is in it. Because I think the more art that's in it, the more enduring it's going to be, the more piercingly it speaks to our human situation.
What would make it the art part? Because it seems that when we're talking about the sort of reveal all, tell all stuff, is that there's very little difference between sort of what Lena Dunham just did and Sonia Sotomayor, mm-hmm. who just wrote a book about, you know, that came out last spring about her growing up in the Bronx. You know, that's a very nice and Oprah thing to do. But there's an art part that you're referring to that I'd like to find out more about.
You know, the art part is the sacrificing any personal details that are included only because they happened, versus inventing details that give certain critical events meaning that anyone can subsequently experience and share. Mm-hmm. The personal is not necessarily universal. It's up to the artist to make the personal universal, and that requires deforming his or her experience. Full stop.
Writer Adam Ross, a fellow this past semester at the American Academy in Berlin. He's the author of the novel Mr. Peanut, and he's currently working on his next novel, Playworld. You can watch a video of Adam's reading from Playworld on our website, americanacademy.de, and of course there you can also learn more about the fellows and the activities here out on the Wannsee. And you can learn more about NPR Berlin's programming, online streaming, and downloads at nprberlin.de. Our program today was written and produced by Jeff Rosenberg, with help from producer Alice Kelly. I'm your host, RJ McGill, hoping you'll join us again for the Berlin Journal.